Welcome to the City Club of Eugene's July 24th, 2020 program, a two-part series looking at accountability, transparency, and reform at the local law enforcement. Today we have part one of that series, Accountability and Transparency in Local Law Enforcement. This is the 40th program of our 2019-20 programming year. I'm Katie Piercy, City Club President-elect. Support for the City Club is provided by members and sponsors. You can become and should become a member of City Club at our website, cityclubofeugene.org. We have business and in-kind sponsors. Our diamond sponsors are 1. Kaiser Permanente exists to provide high-quality, affordable healthcare services to improve the health of our members and the communities we serve. More information at www.kp.org. Next up is the University of Oregon. Since 1876, the University of Oregon has helped Oregonians question critically, think logically, reason effectively, communicate clearly, act creatively, and live ethically. More information at uoregon.edu. Third is Peace Health. Peace Health is proud to serve Eugene, Lane County, and beyond. As your hometown healthcare partner for more than 80 years, their mission is to keep you and your family healthy. Learn more at peacehealth.org. And the last up is Lane Community College. Transforms lives through learning. It provides comprehensive, accessible, high-quality educational opportunities that promote student success. For more information, visit lanecc.edu/programs. We'd also like to acknowledge the generous support from the City of Eugene and Lane County. So on to today's program. As you probably know, the death of George Floyd set off a series of protests across the United States and around the world, prompting greater public attention to excessive use of police force, as well as concerns about police oversight and accountability. Several other deaths, primarily of Black Americans, including Breonna Taylor and Ahmaud Arbery, have compounded and magnified calls for defunding or abolishing the police, in addition to other strategies for police reform. This two-part city program series will examine law enforcement through the lens of recent events. Our speakers are Mark Gisner, Independent Police Auditor for the City of Eugene, Dr. Michael Haynes Garcia, U of O Professor and Eugene Civilian Review Board member. And the third one is Isaiah Wagoner, who's an activist and leader within the movement. I'd like to thank the coordinator of today's program, Josh Purvis, and now it's my pleasure to turn this over to him.
The death of George Floyd on May 25th set off a series of protests across the United States and around the world, prompting greater public attention to excessive use of police force, as well as concerns about police oversight and accountability. Several other deaths, primarily of Black Americans, have compounded and magnified calls for defunding or abolishing the police, in addition to other strategies for police reform. Inspired by these events, local groups have organized marches and protests in Eugene. Newly formed groups, including Black Unity, Black Indigenous People of Color Liberation Collective, and Black-led Action Coalition, range in their specific political objectives, but all represent an emerging pool of young activists motivated primarily by the national Black Lives Matter movement. Like more than 200 communities in the country, Eugene has established some independent oversight of local police through the creation of the Police Auditor's Office and the Civilian Review Board. In contrast, the cities like Minneapolis, Louisville, and Brunswick, Georgia, with larger populations of Black citizens, Eugene is racially quite homogenous as a result of discriminatory policies and practices up to the recent past. More than 83% of the city and almost 90% of the county's population is white, about 4% is Asian, and less than 2% is Black. The record shows the critical need for independent oversight to align enforcement with the community's requirement for impartial justice. This is the first of two City Club programs that will examine local law enforcement through the lens of recent events. The first program accountability and transparency in local law enforcement, will focus on our city's current system of police oversight. Police Auditor Mark Gissner, Professor Michael Hames Garcia, and Black Lives Matter activist Isaiah Wagoner will describe how the system works. They will also highlight potential deficits in that approach and identify opportunities for oversight reform. This timely and urgent conversation will survey Eugene's history of law enforcement and lie at the larger issues around police accountability and reform. At the heart of these programs is the question, how can we cultivate and enforce greater equity, justice, and public safety in our community in light of where we've been and what direction we want to head? So I'd like to now introduce our panelists for today's program. We have Mark Gissner, who is the Eugene Police Auditor, a position he's held since 2009. We also have Dr. Michael Hames Garcia, who is Professor of Indigenous Race and Ethnic Studies at the University of Oregon, and Isaiah Wagoner, a Eugene native and Black Lives Matter activist. Welcome to you all. The motion for today's program to begin is, does the city of Eugene have a sufficient police oversight system to ensure appropriate accountability and transparency? Well, each of the panelists will begin with opening remarks, and then we'll transition into an intra-panel discussion where each of the panelists will be able to respond to the opening remarks of the others. To begin, we'll start with Isaiah Wagoner, a Black Lives Matter activist. Isaiah?
Hi, thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure and an honor. In lieu of the question, does Eugene have a appropriate auditing system for accountability for the Eugene Police Department? I believe they're putting the correct measures in place by having enacting the auditor's panel on there. And we're trying to also enact a community task force, which is provided by the people of the Lane County to be more of people of color to help out in these areas. We believe that Eugene has the right idea. It's just that these ideas aren't maybe being used the correct way, and people aren't exactly sure what the Eugene Audit Office does, Police Auditing Office does for a job. I'm well aware of what they do, but I think that transparency has gotten lost in the message of all of it.
Thank you, Isaiah. So now turn to Dr. Michael Hames Garcia, a U of O professor and member of the Eugene Civilian Review Board. Dr. Hames Garcia, your response to the motion.
Thank you, Joshua. And I also want to express my pleasure at being invited and able to participate in this important discussion. And I'll keep my eye out for the time wave because we talk. But I think that the key words there are sufficient and appropriate. And if we think about the origins of policing in France in the 17th century, policing was developed to deter and respond to crime, among other things, but their biggest function was the creation and maintenance of order. And its purpose, among the unprecedented contrasts of wealth and poverty of 17th century France, was to protect the property of the extremely wealthy and to ensure order for the benefit of commerce, but also to enable the property classes to enjoy their leisure in the city undisturbed. Later, police patrol function was evolved in the Americas, in South Carolina in 1704, and in Saint-Domingue, which became Haiti, the following year. And there, its purpose was also primarily to maintain order, but not so much by protecting property as by patrolling and controlling those who were deemed to be property. So fast forward to the early 19th century, policing is further developed by Sir Robert Peel in colonial Ireland, where the Royal Irish Constabulary ensured proper order and submission to British rule, and then later adapted into an institution for metropolitan England and imported by others to the industrializing Northeast United States. But what we see in this long history of policing is that it's fundamentally and perhaps definitionally an anti-democratic and illiberal institution. As such, if we shall continue to strive for compatibility within democracy for policing, then we can never implement too many constraints on its scope. I think there's no limit, no civil limit on the power of police is too much so long as they continue to exist. Their accountability to civilians whom they may kill and from whom they may seize liberty and property can never be in excess. So the ultimate, so I think that Eugene has a robust system. It has all of the elements, the individual elements, a police commission to advise on policy, an auditor to investigate complaints, civilian review board to review that process of investigation after the fact and determine its transparency and viability. But all of those elements can be stronger. The ultimate authority for policy and for discipline should rest with civilians, who should not redelegate that authority back to the police as a matter of custom. And this isn't because of any kind of personal defect in a given police chief, but because the function of a police chief as the head of an institution is to advocate on behalf of the institution. So all of those decisions, I would say, should rest with civilian authority.
Thank you, Michael, for your open remarks. And to close the open remarks section, I'll now turn to Mark Gissner, the current police auditor with the City of Eugene. So Mark, your response to the motion, does the City of Eugene have a sufficient police oversight system to ensure appropriate accountability and transparency?
Thank you, Joshua. It's kind of a tough act to follow there with Michael. I think this is my fourth City Club appearance for discussing these particular issues. I think it's both a yes and no answer. I think that one thing that I talk about with police, first of all, is they individually have more power than any other person in this nation in terms of taking away a person's freedom, taking away a person's life, and literally destroying their life because they're sworn to tell the truth, and so they're more likely to be believed. And so having that power comes with it certain responsibilities and certain degree of oversight, external oversight, that hasn't always been embraced. I think we have a very robust system. One of the reasons that I came here was because my system under the legislative branch and not the executive branch. And I've worked in oversight under the executive branch, in which you either had a city manager that supported you or didn't support you, or a mayor that supported you or didn't support you. Here we have, I decide what my budget should be. I decide my personnel things. In terms of Isaiah's point about getting more community interaction, I think when we go out for boards and commissions, I think every person on our board currently has at minimum a bachelor's degree. So I think serving on those boards is an intimidating process for people. They feel as they might not be as intellectually cool as others. I think we have at this point two or three attorneys on our board, at least two people with PhDs. So it can be very intimidating for people. We'd like to have more folks on our board from a diverse nature. They're able to do that with a larger police commission. But I think that we maximize our capabilities within the confines of the local legislation and within state legislation. And what surprised me here, coming from Ohio and Cincinnati, is all administrative materials, investigations, personnel records, discipline, are all a matter of public record. Names, discipline, everything. Here, the state of Oregon is very confining with their exemptions for police and safe public safety officers. So what ends up happening is only a few people outside of police bear witness to the entire investigative file. So myself, my staff, the members of the review board are really the only civilians that get to see an entire investigative process. And I think that that's problematic. And then we have no input, as Michael said, into the disciplinary process, which ultimately falls on the city, which could fall on the council. The state recently passed legislation that lists all the police officers and public safety officers who have been decertified since 1971, about 35 years. The other weakness I see that really is the core of the unrest and distrust of police is the process for officer-involved shootings, I think, needs significant repair and significant transparency. So I got my cue that my time is running out, so that I think is a good starting point.
Well, I do appreciate your response, Mark, and as well, Michael and Isaiah. And so now I want to turn to sort of the next portion of the program, which is our intra-panel discussion, and allow you each to respond to what you heard the other two say. So Isaiah, coming back to you here, you know, you've been very prominent in the local Black Lives Matter movement, and I only assume that a lot of the weight or the sense of responsibility falls to organizers like you and others to kind of drive the conversation. And so what you've heard from Michael and Mark is sort of a macro and a micro analysis of the motion. And so that's a lot to kind of, so where do you begin as a leader in the Black Lives Matter community, responding to both the sense of history, but also the sense of kind of getting in the weeds of what the police oversight system is and has been here in Eugene?
So to the community of Black folks, I mean, the history between policing us has been something that's been very daunting and brutal, and we feel like it's stemmed from slavery to police up until now. And so that's where we're seeing a lot of the issues that we're just facing now with the broken window policing and the way the government's being policed across the board with lower income societies, which are highly populated by people of color. We have a protect and serve mentality when we go up into our suburb areas, but then we have a you know, kick in heads mentality when we are in the lower income population. And so that's where a lot of the distrust and disconnect comes from in these areas. And so it's finding how to properly get these funds allocated to the correct entities out there, because we understand as a Black people that police are humans, and that they have lots of what people don't want to talk about, but we need to talk about, is that there are a lot of police going through internal stress on the job, because everybody knows that the defending the public can be a daunting task and very stressful. So you accumulate all that stress, and then an instance comes out, you can only take so much for so long, and you might take it out on the wrong person that has a video camera on you, and we get highlighted moments. So it's getting the police correct health, mental health care, and education awareness for people of color and how to deal in these situations, especially the situations that are non-life threatening, because the first thing they should be doing is stopping to protect and make sure that, you know, the police don't get to decide who's guilty. The judge in the courtroom, that's the disconnect that we're having with police.
Thank you for that, Isaiah. And so, Michael, I'm hearing from what you said earlier, from what Mark said, now how Isaiah responded is, again, this balance of not only the history that you alluded to with sort of inheriting these ideas of law enforcement, but also an experience from a current and a historic community of people of color, particularly a Black community, and their relationship to the police. And so maybe your response now to what you heard Isaiah said, and also bringing in your experience on the Civilian Review Board. So speaking from both as an academic and as someone, a member of the community, what's your response to what you've heard thus far?
I've heard so much. I'm not sure what to respond to first. But I think that the points about, Isaiah's points about the everyday encounters between police and, in particular, African-Americans in our society, these are fraught encounters. And one of the frustrations I think that many reformers feel is that training about implicit bias, about de-escalation, about diversity, the hiring of diverse officers, these are not new reforms. These are reforms that we have seen advocated since the Christopher Commission in the 1960s. Or there was the Kerner. I get the Kerner and the Christopher confused. But these are not new calls. And as common sense as they may sound, they've been resisted by police departments at every turn. Although they have now been implemented in many places. The LAPD, I believe, is about 40% Latinx. And it's not clear that those kinds of changes have changed things. There seems to be something structural in that encounter between law enforcement and members of communities of color, poor communities that have historically faced high levels of policing that needs to be addressed in new ways. There's a great book by James Forman, Policing Our Own, I believe, where he looks at the motivations of the first Black police officers who entered U.S. police forces, and essentially looks at all the different ways that civil rights advocates saw this integration of police forces as a great opportunity for an end to police brutality. I'm talking about the mid-20th century here. And what ended up happening is that the motivations of the individual officers were often not the same as the motivations of civil rights leaders, but also what they were able to do in established police cultures turned out to be very limited, especially when they were small in numbers. So I think this is why we now see calls for not just training police to better handle those encounters, but to find ways to reduce the number of encounters between law enforcement and community members. And so whether that's expanding the kinds of non-armed, non-sworn people who are responding to crises or who are serving our communities or helping out in schools, or whether it's reducing funding for certain kinds of police patrol activities. I think the reason we see these calls emerging today is out of frustration at 50 years of attempts to implement common sense reforms to policing. I'll also, since I guess I haven't seen the wave yet, on the question of inclusivity on boards, I agree completely with Mark that the system, I know when I applied for this civilian review board position, there was a 14-page background check form that I had to fill out, which was, I think, about five times the length of the one I had to fill out to work in the Oregon State Penitentiary. And I had to put down the names of all kinds of different people I was related to and worked with, and I don't think any of them were called. So I have to conclude that process exists largely maybe to deter people from applying. I'm not sure.
Thank you for that. Mark, turning to you to kind of finish out this part of the discussion, what's your response to the perspectives and the insight shared by Michael and Isaiah?
Well, I agree in many aspects. And Michael, on the background things, I think it's the same thing they use as police officers. I'm sure it could be narrowed down. There are certain aspects of it that are actually federal and state requirements that we can't get passed, but yeah, having your friends and things like that. I mean, when they go out and recruit police officers and they go talk to the neighbors and things like that. Well, if you had a falling out with a neighbor, then you have a problem. Probably for decades now, because I've been in this business since 1976 and been in criminal justice since 1978. I've always talked about re-engineering police departments. We essentially have the same model of police departments as we've had for over 100 years. Your detective bureau and your patrol bureau and the hierarchy and the paramilitary structure. I used to say to Chief Kearns, I said, about 25% of your force should be social workers because of the problems that exist now compared to even like when I was growing up in the 60s, people would steal a car for the money to take care of the family or to buy things. And now people steal cars so they can get the money for drugs or and those kinds of things. So many of their contacts are people with mental illness issues, substance abuse issues. And then we're so small here, you know, in terms of a city and per capita numbers, that every response is a radio call. There's little, if any, proactive policing, if you will. So what happens to the community member is a police officer is just seen as an action figure. And to a police officer, the person they come in contact with the community is an action figure who could be dangerous. And so those approaches to those kinds of things, because again, I came from a city of 300,000 people that had 1,000 police officers. And there were police officers at community meetings and were assigned to neighborhoods and actually had beats and got to know people in the community. Here, it's just call to call to call. They also know that they're in a hurry. And so even with the benefit of having the cahoots, it's still cahoots just goes from call to call to call. There's no interaction with the community. Other than, you know, in the summer, we have the surge of downtown officers because we have the surge of more people who find downtown safe. So all those things go back to my point of it's really time to re-engineer what police departments look like. They don't have to be the same as they looked for 100 or the past 150 years. And again, I go back to that whole transparency thing about then the community needs to know everything that's going on. Because as Isaiah said, I don't think the racism has changed. It's just it's on film more. And then the last aspect is the recruitment point is there was a time when DPSST, which is the Department of Public Safety, essentially the training academy for the state of Oregon, not too long ago, about 25% of those people, recruits, were from the military. And I love people from the military, always have, but when 25% of your workforce in a civilian role, such as policing, is military, they're also trained in a certain way. And part of that training is to never retreat. And so we're not getting the diversity in intellectual thought and intellectual width within our police departments because of the type of people that end up becoming police officers, many, many great people. Nevertheless, not a divergent group, not representative of the communities currently.
All right, well, thank you, Mark, for those comments, and also to Michael and Isaiah for your comments so far. We're gonna move next into a Q&A section. I'm gonna start with you, Isaiah, and then I'm gonna ask the same question to you, Michael. And that question is racial justice the best lens to examine local law enforcement here in Eugene? How important is race to understanding inequities in our criminal justice system compared to homelessness, mental illness, and substance abuse, all those issues that Mark brought up in the previous section? So Isaiah, I'll start with you, your response.
Absolutely.
there's a lot to unpack, like I said initially. It started really, you know, way back in the day before we were all here, and then with Nixon's war on drugs and making drugs a crime, which we already know the higher populations of people of color were predominantly doing drugs that would be seen as things that could incriminate them and incarcerate them. And so with mass incarcerations of black fathers going to prison, you have single mothers working more than one or two jobs, and it's leaving children home uneducated for a long since. And then you got the pipeline through school to prison is a real thing through all of that. So the scope of starting with racial justice and equality and all of those type of wonderful things, it's just, like I said, it's securing the accountability of the police officers that do break the law on a national scale, and having a national outlook of how we can actually do this with the Justice Act of 2020 that they're proposing as a bill that's not really holding much weight, because no one wants to preach the actual police transformation like I was talking about earlier. And that's exactly what we're wanting to preach. We want to see, look at all the systems across the board so we can have a national standard. And it starts with looking at the broken police policies that are going through our neighborhood, looking at the knocking heads mentality in the lower class system versus the protect and serve in the highly suburbed areas. So it starts there, but it also starts on a national level of re-looking at the war on drugs and making it a national health crisis that we could get these people health benefits to, properly rehabilitate them in a sense.
Thank you for that, Isaiah. And Michael, coming to you, the same question. I guess where I'm really kind of curious, and I'm really interested in your perspective, being both an academic with a vast understanding of these issues historically and nationally, but also as a member of the Civilian Review Board, and the question is a lot of the discourse around police accountability and police brutality and the way it's being framed nationally, is there a lot of overlap there, and are concerns here in the Eugene area when it comes to law enforcement and the communities they most often interact with?
One of the things that I one of my mantras in teaching about these issues, and particularly in relation to places like Oregon or say West Virginia or Vermont, where the population, as you noted, is historically and currently less diverse, shall we say, is that race is central, but maybe not constitutive of the problems, right? So there's more going on. There are more people who are police than just black people or people or other people of color. But how these issues, whether we're talking about the ones that you listed, homelessness, mental illness, substance abuse, or criminal justice more broadly, how these have been framed for us as a nation, as Isaiah was pointing out, have been inseparable from the history of racial inequality in our country. If we think back to the 1970s and the beginnings of the war on drugs, There were many moments where our nation could have taken a different turn. President Ford had a commission that recommended addressing the heroin and other substance addiction issues through treatment as well, and as well as criminal justice. And only one half of that got followed up with as we moved into the Reagan administration. But just to very quickly, I'll wrap up on this issue by observing, this is from Mark Maurer in his book, Race to Incarcerate, that in the 1990s, hundreds of white crack traffickers were prosecuted in state courts, even as not a single white offender from the Los Angeles area was convicted of a crack offense in federal court. right? Despite the fact that whites comprise the majority of crack users. And so these ostensibly race-neutral policies are always interpreted and enacted by courts, by DAs, by police, who have historically enforced them unequally around race.
Thank you for that. And so I want to come to you, Mark, next. You know, the office, the position you hold in the office you're part of, you know, has a, let's say, a fairly recent history, as similar to the creation of the Eugene Civilian Review Board. So I'm curious if you can give us some background as to what were the events or circumstances that gave rise to the creation of the Independent Police Auditor's Office and the Civilian Review Board. Mark?
That's a long answer. I did want to touch on that point of racial justice. Having worked in public health, it almost, the racial injustice almost starts at prenatal care. I mean, if you look at healthcare delivered to young African Americans versus whites, and having worked in that and looking at infant mortality rates and things like that, I mean, if you want to start there and then all the way through our educational system, our employment systems and things like that. But in terms of the start of our office, there was my understanding, I wasn't here, and we don't get a lot of news about Oregon in Ohio. So was that two officers engaged in criminal conduct involving people who were more likely to be introduced in the criminal justice system if they didn't acquiesce to these criminal sexual acts of these two officers. And so that once that came to light, I think in 1999, because it's 21 years old now, I suppose in some way it's a little bit comforting that we're still talking about events from 21 years ago, as opposed to the more recent past. But that put into motion in Eugene committees, and that helped create our office and the review board, and started up back in 2008. So it's been going for about 12 years now. And I think in terms of the structure in our industry, in the oversight industry, is I have as much penetration into a police department as anyone in this, any other agency in this nation. In terms of every day, we look at every use of force, we watch a lot of the body worn video, all those things. We have all that penetration, but we don't have the ability within the structure of public record laws, for example, to talk about those. We have very little penetration in officer-involved shootings until it's way after the fact and after the investigative team looks at it and the district attorney. So that's a bit disconcerting for me because, again, in Ohio, we had a tremendous amount of penetration in terms of officer-involved shootings and then being able to talk about it in public. If you look at Tamir Rice in Cleveland, immediately all that information was given to the public. And if you, whether you agreed or disagreed with any of the decisions being made or the conviction or the actually found not guilty in that case, everything was being viewed by the public. So that was comforting for the public. In terms of then how we've progressed, certainly having a charter significantly helped the process. There are very few civilian oversight agencies that were created by charter, which would require then to overturn that a vote of the people. Rarely in any community in this nation do you see politicians bringing forward a charter motion to create this kind of things because it creates so much structure. So you see things occur where then the executive branch minimizes it. I think the only other place, and I may be wrong about this, is the Milwaukee Police and Fire Commission actually can hire and fire. And that is actually, I think, one of the few civilian groups in the nation that has that ability at the local level among 16,000 police departments in our country.
Thank you for that, Mark. And Michael, I want to come to you as a member of the Civilian Review Board. Do you think the board has sufficient oversight authority? And if not, what are some of the major changes you would like to see made in how the board implements and enforces standards of accountability and transparency? Michael?
Yeah. So I would say that I'll speak as an individual board member rather than as a first person plural for the board. I often feel frustrated with extent to which we don't have access to, as Mark was saying, disciplinary records. So we come in at the very end of the stage, or perhaps even after the fact, to do a review. So with the exception of community interest cases where we take a different role, but a complaint is made, the auditor and internal affairs investigate this, and then recommendations are made to the chief. The chief makes their decision about discipline or about whether to follow the recommendations of the internal affairs or the auditor, and then we're brought in by the auditor's office to review the investigation, and we don't get to know we have a tremendous amount of access to things like body worn video, to the transcripts of interviews, and so we do have a lot of access. And I think that our greatest contribution to the process is to give it some transparency. When we discuss cases, we do so at public meetings, and so the public has and complainants have a sense that some civilians have had a chance to look at all of the material relevant to the complaint, and to evaluate how the investigation happened, and that's terrific. It would be great to have access to the disciplinary records. It would be great to know that an auditor's office had more independence in its investigative processes. There are points in the investigative process where the auditors have to defer to internal affairs, for example, when they're doing interviews of some officers, and so I'm definitely an advocate for more power and more access. Much as I said, the chief police advocate for their office, I would always be an advocate for expansion of the powers of the review board.
Thank you for that, and Isaiah, coming to you now. You know, just what you heard from Michael and his experience on the Civilian Review Board, my question to you would be, have you considered joining the Eugene Civilian Review Board or even the Police Commission? And do you think there's a benefit to Black Lives Matter organizers getting more involved in the existing police oversight system?
My lady Chantel Robertson has applied for the police panel and is one of the finalists. So I do believe there is a big value in having more people of color apply for multiple positions. I'm always an advocate of all of that. And that's what we're trying to achieve with my new network, which is the Minority Freedom Network, within the confines of that. Pretty much it's things like instances like Ryan Stone. We have officers that don't have a communal base of registered information of this officer was fired for this, problematic, hired here within Lane County, problematic. So it's, why are we having problematic issues with officers being rehired in other counties that are, grandfather counties to us? So close. We have all these panels and we have all these boards, but people are still feeling hopeless and feeling like there is no justice because everything stops with the union. Where is the union at in this conversation? Where is the union member sitting here answering some of this question? And so some people are feeling like the union holds so much value and it protects what we're trying to get people to look into further. So
you know, having these individuals here are great, but it's just, it's what are the union standards? How do they operate? And what are the next steps for when they see problematic issues?
Thank you. And just to note, and correct me if I'm wrong, Ryan Stone, who you mentioned, Isaiah, was an officer with the Springfield Police Department, for clarification. But point taken, though, and Michael, I want to come back to you with this question. You know, Isaiah mentioned the police union. Now, I'm curious, you know, who's not a part of the conversation with the public that should be? You know, we have the Eugene Police Employees Association. I've heard mention of Chief Skinner, and to program note, Chief Skinner will be joining the City Club program next week on police reform, but also think about the district attorney. Who is significant to this conversation here locally, but may not be as publicly known as a critical factor in meaningful reform when it comes to transparency and accountability? Michael?
Yeah, thank you. So I'm a typical academic, and then I'm a critic. So I will criticize anyone and everyone. And so I have plenty of criticism for Eugene, even though I think that as these things go, we have a very good system in place in the city of Eugene. Where I think we really need to bring more people into the conversation is at the county level. So as you said, the district attorney's office, Oregon has an unfortunate practice of nominating new or appointing new district attorneys a few months before a sitting district attorney retires. So then they run as an incumbent. This is the case with Patricia Perlow, who is our current district attorney in Lane County. So she's never had to run for her office except as an incumbent. What that means is that we have a woeful lack of debate over what the district attorney's role is in Oregon counties, and vetting of competing visions for those positions. The Lane County Sheriff's Office, so we have this very robust system of oversight, civilian oversight and input for the city of Eugene, but not for the city of Springfield, not for the county of Lane. And insufficient, I would say, at the state level. One of the things that I have would like to see is a greater role for the Oregon Department of Justice in investigating complaints against police departments in rural areas or at the county and the state level.
Thank you, Michael. I want to turn back to you, Mark. You know, something that was mentioned earlier by Michael is, if I understood right, is, you know, a strong advocacy for more power to sort of civilian oversight. And so I guess the question I have for you as someone who you mentioned, you know, relative to the system here, has the most kind of awareness of what happens within EPD, but also is engaged with the civilian oversight system. My question is there such thing as too much transparency when it comes to the public's awareness of and attention to law enforcement personnel and operations?
There's very little in terms of the strategic side. For example, they don't want people to know what the strategies are of the SWAT team, for example. But again, I think that's old thinking. I wanted to touch on one point. I think one area that we never talk about, judges. We never talk about judges run uncontested in for nearly every seat in circuit court. We never talk about that they're not allowed to have a political campaign. They're not allowed to debate each other about what their philosophies are or what their opinions are on particular issues. So we if you look at your ballot, I think in every judge race for circuit court, as far back as I can remember, there's only one name there. And I think that is a flawed system if we really want to understand, because police officers don't sentence people to prison. District attorneys don't sentence people to prison. Judges sentence people to prison. And when, you know, and in that system, I think that it's problematic when, again, there that structure is always excluded from the debate. In terms of having more power. I'm just really, in Cincinnati, we had far more officer-involved shootings. So we had far more involvement, and it was a very streamlined process. Here, it's pretty rare. I've spoken publicly about that because at the end of the day, it's those deaths in custody and officer-involved shootings that really cause the public to erupt about how the police are behaving themselves. So I would like to have more of that. If you look, again, what the public doesn't know is there's three officers right now pending to lose their certification, three former Eugene officers pending to lose their certification from the state of Oregon, but people don't know about it. And when you look at that whole list over the last 40 years, there's a number of Eugene police officers in which we had a significant input into that person being brought up on internal charges and at times criminal charges. So again, I don't think there can be too much transparency other than some of the strategic things they might do from, say, an undercover standpoint, you know, the identity of an undercover police officer, for example.
Thank you for that. So that concludes the Q&A portion of the program. We'll close with a series of final remarks by our panelists. We'll begin first with Mark Gissner, the police auditor for the city of Eugene. Mark, your closing remarks.
Thank you, Joshua. It's been great being part of this panel. I just have a couple of minutes. I think we have a very good system of oversight in Eugene. In our industry, I think we are as strong as any within the confines of state law in terms of public records. I think we maximize our capability based on the legislation, whether local or state, that we must follow. And I think that in that aspect, I think we do a very good job. I think one of the weaknesses is, of course, is there's just a very small group of community members that get to bear witness to everything that goes on in the police department. And I think that police trust us value that we have is difficult in today's society. We do an awful lot of work. We have multiple access points for complaints. They do deliberate cases, although they don't name names. The review board does deliberate cases. We offer opportunities for public comment. We have hired a community engagement specialist to engage people in the Latinx community because of the language difficulties, and I think those have worked out very well. But there are things I think that can be better, particularly done through that is being currently blocked by legislation or in legislation that could make us a stronger agency.
Thank you, Mark. Michael, your closing remarks.
Yeah. So I have never been arrested or charged with anything more serious than exceeding the speed limit. I was raised to respect authority and obey the law. Yet since I was 16, people have called police because I looked suspicious. And every time I have an encounter with law enforcement, I experience terror. No matter how friendly or unbiased they are, it's a traumatic event for me. And I'm always grateful to have avoided harm afterwards. The scene always evokes for me the experience of a schoolyard bully stopping me to ask me what's up. Is the question a trap? How should I answer? Should I make eye contact or will that antagonize them? What if averting my eyes provokes them? What should I do with my hands? Do they have a reason to stop me or is this just to torture me? I can't afford to entertain the thought that they're simply being friendly because my life is at stake and I'm not Black. So I think that to the extent that we take these issues seriously at all, we need to understand them from the perspective of people whose every experience with law enforcement has been filled with terror. That's why I think that a role for civilian oversight can never be too great, can never be too broad.
Thank you for that. And to round us out, Isaiah, your closing remarks.
Yes, let me say thank you very much. It was an honor and a pleasure. And I do want to say, first and foremost, Black Lives Matter. pretty much what we want as a society and what we're looking for, you know, with my network of Minority Freedom Network, an approach to hold police accountable, to end racial profiling, to change the culture of law enforcement through transformation, empower other community members to build trust between communities and law enforcement, which is hard, but to end systemic racism and police brutality. As we stated before, I would like to have an actual Rehabilitation Act, not the 1973 Rehabilitation Act, but a real Rehabilitation Act, of which we preach that if we believe that sending these people through jail, and once they come out, they can come to a society that is with open arms versus closed arms. You don't qualify for this. You have charges, so you can't be here, which is putting people on the streets. Oh, you're a criminal for theft with property damage, has everything to do with your charges. So you're instantly denied and on the streets, which is contributing to homelessness, which is contributing to stress, which is contributing to a major drug problem. And then the war on drugs is putting a circle right back into the police, into policing. So with all that being said, We want accountability at the top for when police are profiling us. We want rehabilitation to be enacted of people of color. And we want a task force to be put in place so we can look at the system structures in its place to see what we need to change and vote. And if we have these policies enacted now, we need full discretion and transparency of things that the common man in everyday society person can understand, not just multiple clauses of 14 pages, but a quick outline of A to B, C.
Got it. And I want to thank our panelists. Again, we have Isaiah Wagner, a Black Lives Matter activist, Dr. Michael Haymes Garcia, a U of O professor and member of the Eugene Civilian Review Board, and Mark Gissner, the Eugene Police Auditor. Thank you all very much. And you have been listening to a City Club program. The motion today was, does the city of Eugene have a sufficient police oversight system to ensure appropriate accountability and transparency? Next week, we will continue with the next part of our two-part series on policing reform, accountability, and transparency in law, local law enforcement. I'm Josh Purvis, and thank you for listening to City Club.
This has been our July 24th program, Accountability and Transparency in Local Law Enforcement. I'd like to recognize some gold sponsors: Lavis Cobb, AARP of Oregon, and Network Charter School. It's our expectation to have a taped conversation available by Friday at noon. We want to thank you for you all for supporting us during this difficult time. We want to send a thank you to our in-kind sponsors as well: KRVM 91.9 Radio, PAC Info and Simplified Computing LLC, Dot Dotson's Photography, and again, Network Charter School. And a special thank you to public radio station KLCC 89.7 for continually airing City Club programs on Mondays at 7 o'clock. And thank you to Community Television of Lane County, Cable Channel 29, for televising recent City Club programs. Please join us on July 31st for the second part of this series. More details and information about future programs can be found online at City Club website, cityclubofeugene.org. I want to thank very much our speakers for today. They did a wonderful job and really added to the community conversation. This concludes today's program.